we're live. We are back again on the Big Hunt Guys podcast. Do you ever listen to the podcast and think, like, you're kind of sad we don't have, like, a real fancy intro?
Sometimes I do, yes. Sometimes I'm like, it'd be really cool. Sometimes I'm like, I just kind of roll right into whatever I want to talk about.
But then I thought, it's usually like an elk bugling in the background, you know?
Why would you choose an elk?
I knew you wouldn't like that because they make this awesome noise. We get a turkey gobbling, but it wouldn't
what
be
about
on
a buck grunt?
Wouldn't be on brand.
Like a whitetail.
Like a whitetail grunt. Is that your best buck grunt? I don't know. That's one thing I've never done, actually.
You never have?
Never tried to grunt in a whitetail.
So the third whitetail buck I killed in Minnesota, shotgun season.
Mm-hmm.
I remember the old Primos can.
Oh, yeah, the can.
The can.
Mm-hmm. That's a doe bleat, though, right?
Yeah, doe bleat. Mm-hmm. So I used that, and then, like, no joke, 25, 30 minutes later, I shot my buck, my biggest whitetail buck ever.
Did you feel like he came right in, or was
it
just
high? He must have been coming in because he was coming down a trail, but, like, that's what they do, and it was during November.
Uh-huh.
So, like, maybe it worked in, like, 25 minutes.
Didn't hurt.
Can't say it fully worked, but.
Yep.
So we could have a doe bleat in this intro.
Yeah, we could do that. A little those cans, I think, are pretty easy. I could probably use one of those.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder if those work on a muley.
I tried, actually.
Bring in a fawn? Bring in a doe?
When I went to College of Montana,
mm-hmm.
Behind campus, there was a bunch of mule deer, and I'd always go up there and play around with them, take photos and whatever. So I tried bringing some stuff up once. I was like, whatever, let's just see if it works. Just not work.
Like in November?
Yeah,
November. When they're rutting?
Did not work.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, I wish you could call those muleys in.
Wouldn't it be cool?
It would be way fun. Yeah, rattling. They said when we were in Hawaii that you can rattle those deer in.
Really?
Yeah, I was going to say Sitka deer, but those are axis deer.
Hmm.
They say the same thing with Sitka deer, I think, is that rattling works decent.
Huh.
But I've never tried either. So
don't they do it with blacktails?
I can't speak to it. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's what they say. I never tried it. It would be fun. I think it'd be fun. They say in Texas, right? Like South Texas, rattling is super effective.
Mm-hmm.
That would be a riot just to sit with the rattling horns and watch a big buck come strolling in.
Gosh, that would be epic.
Yep. We're going to do a Q&A podcast today. So basically what happened is, unfortunately, I get DMs that I don't get back to. I try to get back to a lot of people if I can, but occasionally if I am driving or if I'm working and I'm trying to do something and I read one and then I don't get to it.
That's what I do.
That's the problem is like, I'll click on it, I'll read it, and then I'll have good intentions of getting back to it, but I don't always.
Yeah.
And so then I feel bad that I haven't got back to people. So hopefully the people that have reached out and sent DMs, if I haven't got back to you, first and foremost, my apologies. Second, I'm going to try to hopefully answer some of your questions today on a podcast. So I went through and I picked out, I've got six. I think you've got six or so, which is probably what we can get through in an hour, hour and a half, and try to run through some Q&As. We are like right in the midst of like really kicking off hunting season. Like it's coming fast and furious. So I'm going to go out hopefully and just pick up an OTC elk tag in my home state of Utah and go see if I can shoot a nice cow or a big fat spike elk.
Yeah, I've been running around crazy myself.
Yeah.
Since last.
How far off are you before you actually get hunting? Is this a hard time of year for you? Because you don't really bow hunt much. So
yeah.
Is it weird that like people are out bow hunting right now? Like
it is.
Lorenzo's been out.
Yeah. So I was with Lorenzo here the last week.
Mm-hmm.
I let him tell everything that's happened. We're heading back out again.
Yep.
We had to come back just for a day. So I'm in the office today, leaving again tonight, hunting for another 4 days. But yeah, we've had some
yeah. And I picked up that antelope tag and that was the first of August. And I think I shot a buck the third. Yeah. Of August. So it was like already gone. And then, like I said, Utah, we're in the midst of archery elk season and deer hunts are kicking off all over. So I always wondered, do you feel weird about that? Because
I wish I was out doing something.
I bet. When do you first kick off?
October. So I guess I got a full month.
That's so far away.
I know. And like right now, helping Lorenzo is awesome. I'm glassing up bucks every single day, learning deer, but it's like, I want to be.
Yeah, you want to be hunting.
I want to be hunting for myself in a way, but I love being other people helping them too. But it's like, I need to go gather intel for my hunt.
Yeah, yeah.
And so after this hunt, I roll around, and then the next week I leave to go help our hunt winner.
That's right. You're going on that. That'll be fun.
So that'll be really fun.
Are you going to New Mexico?
New Mexico. So he's flying in on like Friday morning early. rallying, driving all the way over there, picking up the camera guy in New Mexico. Cause I was like, you could ride with us for a million hours in a vehicle, or you could fly partway, pick you up, and then ride the rest of the way. So the camera guy's flying in New Mexico, meeting up with Blackhorn.
Yep.
Blackhorn guys, I'm going to hang out with them.
Ryan and Cole?
I think Cole's going to join us. Yeah, that's what
that'd be good.
The rumor on the street.
That'd be fun. Cole's a good dude.
Yeah.
I like hanging out with Cole.
So that'd be good. And I got the 6.8 Western all dialed for him. So he's going to use my rifle. And
gotcha.
It'll be his first antelope ever.
Dude, antelope are so cool.
Yeah. So that'll be a fun one. So I got that in between. And then after that, the whole month of September is just scouting every single weekend.
Yeah. Try to make the most of your tag when it rolls around in October.
Yeah.
Dude, when you said October, like it did leave a little bit of a pit in my stomach thinking that like that's a long ways away.
And the problem is, so you know,
because the month of September for me is like the holy grail, right? So like every September, I'm pretty much out a lot of the month, like to either chase an elk or archery deer or something, you know?
Yeah, and I canceled everything else I had. Like I've talked about before, I've turned in other mule deer tags I've had. So like this is all I'm focusing on is just this hunt. And the thing that stings a lot is I realize, okay, archery's already open right now in Nevada. There's already bucks dying.
Oh, yeah.
I already heard of one of the deer that I have. It's got an arrow into it.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And
dead?
I heard the shot was really high.
Okay, gotcha.
And I think the deer might live.
Yeah.
But who knows? So,
but you already know that. You already heard that.
So yeah. One of the deer's already got an arrow into him, whether he lives or not. Like I guess already stings a little bit.
Sure.
I still have 2 months to wait till I can hunt.
Yeah, that's crazy.
And then you got a muzzleloader hunting in between there.
Yeah, those highly sought after tags or something, right? Because it's like, I mean, those people are after them, right?
People
like,
are after them. Then you're after the top end, right?
Yeah, people have put a lot of time and effort into scouting and all summer long and spending it. They usually have a buck or two that they're planning on hunting. And that's a real stinger.
I know, right?
Yeah, that would
He's a cool buck. It was one I don't know fully if I was going to go after. But just a cool buck. I won't describe him at all yet. Wait till after the season to talk about him. But
he wouldn't have been your number one.
Wasn't my number one.
Okay. No. Well, that's interesting.
That's decent then. But like, he was still cool. He's still a buck that I don't have yet.
Yeah, he was a buck that you would have hunted potentially at some point throughout the hunt.
Maybe. Yeah. Mm.
Are there other hunts between your hunt and that hunt, or is that
muzzleloader?
Okay, so it's just an early muzzleloader.
Yeah. Gotcha.
Man, that's a lot of like time between the two to like sit on your hands and wait.
That's why I really want to get out and put glass on things. Like, obviously, I pulled all my cameras because they had to be pulled in by August 1st and been slowly analyzing that. Porter keeps thinking I'm, like, kidding. He's like, I know you've analyzed all your trail cameras. I'm like, bro, every one of my trail cameras has 7,000 to 9,000 photos on it.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of cattle, a lot of feral horses.
So you got them out by the date?
Yep, barely. Got them pulled out. I wanted to wait till them soak as long as possible.
Mm-hmm.
So I pulled them whatever that is, the 30th and the 31st of July.
So I was
just did two straight days. And the first night I pulled up cameras till 3:30 in the morning.
Really?
And I wanted a glass the next morning, but completely missed my alarm. I was exhausted.
Yeah.
And
it's a lot of work, isn't it?
Oh,
yeah. Running cameras is a lot of work.
Especially when they're all over the place. And like some I have to hike in, some I can drive to, but all the locations are different. So you're constantly just riding around listening to podcasts in a truck and then hopping on a four wheeler or hiking. And then I finished pulling them the next night at like, literally 11:45 p.m.
So I think it was, might have been the 1st of August, or it was close to, might have been the 30th or something like that of July. I was at the local Maverick, and I hope you won't mind me saying this, but I ran, maybe I shouldn't say his name, but yeah, maybe I won't. But I ran into a friend at the Maverick who was out of town. And if he listens to the podcast, he'll know who I'm talking about. But he was down pulling cameras. He'd been down there for a week, right? Like running around pulling cameras and trying to get them all in. And he was asking me, he's like, what do you think the percentage of cameras that actually get pulled prior to that August 1st deadline? And whether you're talking Nevada or Utah, I was in Utah at the time, but what do you think? How many, did you have any kind of gauge on that based on you pulling cameras?
When I was running around pulling, there's only two locations that still had a camera on July 31st.
So everybody else pulled them.
Yeah. Like no joke, there were some that had legit 30 plus cameras on it.
That's interesting.
And majority of them all pulled. And they easily could have been pulled after I left. Like there was still obviously time left to pull them. So maybe someone got and hit them, but like, yeah, I can't
only
think
two
of,
though.
Only two. Like no joke, only two.
That's pretty good.
Yeah.
That's more than I would have thought. Mm-hmm. I was talking to him and I thought maybe 50%, but maybe I don't know.
It could be if you stretch yourself so thin where you can't do it. Like I tried to make sure that's why You know, I time everything when I'm driving into roads. I'm timing how long it takes me to drive in my vehicle, sure. how long it takes me to load my ATV. That way I know later on when I'm hunting actually how long it takes to get into some of the spots. So I had a really good gauge on like mm-hmm. the estimate time, but then, you know, I'm pulling posts, you know, I'm getting my camera off it, like getting that, strapping it on the ATV, driving to the next spot. So like that all adds up. And then of course I can't resist. And so I'm plugging it into my computer, the SD card.
Yeah,
and trying to do a quick little scroll to look through. So I'm burning time there.
Yeah, you have to. I get that.
But yeah, I mean, if you were to do more than I did, like you're going to definitely run into, you probably need 3 or 4 days. Like 2 days was barely enough to pull the amount of cameras I had.
Dude, and then he posed the question to me. He's like, what do you do if you find the camera and it's out past the deadline? Like say it's the middle of August or you're into September and you find a camera, like what do?
Leave it.
Yeah. I mean, I don't do anything. I guess I just leave it. That's between them and
yeah.
them and the law, I guess.
Mm-hmm. And you gotta think too, there are probably some people that put out a camera and maybe they checked it once and then they looked at the card later and didn't have anything worth. It's like, maybe they forgot about it. Maybe it's a camera where mm-hmm. it wasn't worth the effort for them to go check it. Like you could have that too. Like, what do you do in that situation?
Yeah,
like,
but you're still supposed to have it pulled, right? Yeah, I mean, if you put it out according to the law, you're supposed to have it pulled. Which I guess you're supposed to keep track of your cameras and have
keep
them
track of your cameras because you put them on public land.
Yeah, according to the law, right?
According to the law.
Yeah, I was like, I don't know. I mean, I don't turn them in. I don't touch the camera. I leave it be. Like it's not.
No, I would. There's no way I would ever touch a camera because that's like, even if it's there past it and they're technically supposed to be down, like you touching it is also bad.
Would you turn somebody in if you knew whose camera it was?
That's a good question.
I don't know.
Are you required to? Like
I don't know.
That's a good question.
I don't know if you are or not, but I don't know. It made me think, and I don't know that I have an answer.
Yeah, I don't know if I'd ever know.
There's part of me that wants to say, yeah, I would, because they're breaking the law. But at the same time, I don't look at it as the same as like poaching a deer, you know?
Yes.
Which I would definitely, indefinitely turn somebody in for that. You know what
100%.
I mean? 100%. Some kind of game violation, I feel like I wouldn't, but maybe that's a game violation. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know how
that's like
deal
one
with
of
that.
Those ones I sat there and wrestled with it for a minute when I was out running the dog, and I was like, oh, I don't know what I would do.
Yeah.
I don't know. Leave it alone. I wouldn't touch it. I know that.
Yeah, because then even if you touch it and like, oh, I'm going to take it, now you're technically the new owner of the camera and you're kind of breaking the law in a sense by you touching that camera and taking it out by pulling it past the August 1st deadline. So you could technically get in trouble.
I wouldn't pull it. There's no way I would pull somebody else's camera.
Yeah, neither would
I. Not a chance. That's their property.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's between them and the law. Anyway.
I don't know. That's a weird one.
Food for thought.
No.
Man, what else is there? Anything else you want to talk about before we dive in? Hit promo probably here in a minute.
Hit promo. We still got our Refer a Friend program going on right now, which is basically your chance to get $1,000 to the Going Gear Shop. So refer a friend, and every friend you refer, basically you're already an insider. So let's say Trail, you have an insider account and you want to refer your buddies. So everybody you sign up, you're going to get 75 points at the Going Gear Shop. They're going to get 75 points. So all they need to do is sign up using your email address.
Mm-hmm.
And you use that as a promo code in their little thing. So a new member will sign up using your email address. That person who's the insider member gets 75 points. The new person gets $75 to the Going Gear Shop. And then that person, if they sign up a fourth person to join insider, who hasn't been insider, you're going to get $1,000.
Yeah, which is great.
Phenomenal opportunity to get $1,000 to spend.
You get a lot of gear. You get a new pack.
Get some new boots.
Oh, yeah.
Get some optics.
You get a couple pairs of boots. A
couple pairs of boots, yes.
Yeah. Yeah, a couple pairs.
Dozen arrows.
At least.
A couple dozen.
Probably get, how many dozen arrows could you get? Depends on the arrows you got, but you probably get three dozen maybe.
Yeah.
3 or 4 dozen arrows.
And all you had to do is refer your buddies.
Which is about what I would need for a year.
Everyone has probably some buddies they're going to go hunting with at some point, so mm-hmm. might as well get them converted over to Go Hunt.
Yeah.
They can use all mapping. They can use Insider during application season, filtering, app strategies, draw mm-hmm. odds. All the research is in the mobile app.
Yep.
Pretty sweet thing. And you get $1,000
sweet,
for four
deal.
People.
Yeah. And then the other thing, I hope we still have it going on, but we've been celebrating Go Hunt's birthday, which has been going on. We've had daily deals. So you check back into the Go Hunt gear shop to see what the daily deal is for the day. So we've got different products that we can offer at a great deal just to celebrate Go Hunt's birthday, which I think is 12 or 13, somewhere in that neighborhood. But yeah, we got those daily deals in the shop, so check back to see if there's a piece of gear that's on sale that you might pick up prior to the season. With that, should we dive into some questions?
Yeah, do a little Q&A.
Do you want to start?
Sure.
Okay. What you got?
Okay. Which do I go easy?
Are you going to mix them up?
I'll mix them up. So this is I wrote down the names.
Oh, you did? Good. I didn't.
I didn't write down the
full apologies.
Thing. So these are DMs I got on Instagram.
Okay.
And again, I was just like trail and I'm really bad at responding to DMs unless caught me in a good moment. So here we go. This is from Eric. Hey man, my buddy drew a New Mexico elk tag for second archery.
Okay.
Neither of us have ever hunted south of Colorado.
Mm-hmm.
Any advice or suggestions that would be different than hunting in more of the northern type states?
Right.
So he's got an archery elk tag in New Mexico.
Second season, which I think is the 14th through the 25th.
Yep.
Which is kind of prime time for rut, I would think, this year. You're on the dark side of the moon, so I think full moon's the 7th. So I was looking at the calendar the other day because I did a podcast with the PNWild guys and they were asking me about moon phases and elk hunting and stuff. So I was kind of glancing at the calendar, but it looks like we should have an excellent rut this year as far as moon phase goes. So I like the middle of the month. New Mexico's, the further south you get, right? So a lot of Colorado, you've got like your more typical elk country. You got aspen, pine, big pockets. I mean, certainly there are some areas where you've got like pinyon and juniper, some sagebrush country, some oak, like you get west, like some of that Grand Junction country, I guess some of the lower stuff. And even north of there, you've got some like rolling oak and PJ type terrain. You get into New Mexico or you get into Arizona, there's some of that country, depending on the hunt that he has, like you can, some of it you can get, it's like pretty arid, right? So it's pinyon and juniper, sagebrush country. So do you hunt them differently? Is that the question?
Kind of, yep.
Then you wouldn't call
it tips for hunting like different country. I'm assuming he's meaning more arid country.
Because
you could have the situation. I mean, we had that film come out, Letters from Home.
Yep.
And
that's high alpine stuff.
High alpine type hunting. So that kind of seems similar to maybe to some of the states. Like you can still hunt high alpine for elk in a lot of the western states. But like I'm assuming he's meaning more arid, dry conditions rather than hunting like a your typical.
Yeah.
Like where there's still arid, dry conditions in Colorado, but like what would be the differences?
I mean, if it's more arid, I would become much more familiar with where your water sources are because most of the water that those bulls are going to be using is going to be like stock ponds. So dirt ponds or metal corrugated tanks or whatever that ranchers are going to maintain for their livestock that are you know, grazing on public land. So I would probably put a lot more time and emphasis into finding those water points because those elk are big and it's hot and it's arid. And, you know, when they're rutting, they're expending a bunch of energy. So they're going to be hitting water probably at least every day, I would think. So I would definitely know where those are. And then I would let that kind of dictate where maybe I start, but I would still hunt them just like I would in, you know, timber high, like typical elk country. So I would still run and gun. I'd still bugle. Dude, hunting elk in PJ is awesome. Like if they're rutting and they're bugling, it's awesome because you have enough cover that you can close the distance, but it's open enough that once you usually get within like 80 to 100 yards, like you've got shooting lanes, right? So to me, I actually love PJ hunting, especially if the bulls are rutting and like really going at it. I think that's one of the best opportunities to kill a bull because you can close the gap, but you still got a bit of cover, but you got openings for shots. So I'd still hunt them the same. I would just probably the biggest difference I would use is I'd probably spend a lot of time just exploring where those stock ponds are. As far as like Colorado, you know, typical elk country, aspen, pine, conifer, big north facing slopes, bedding, saddles, benches, seeps, wallows, all that I would say too applies to a lot of the elk country in New Mexico that I've hunted. It's been your typical elk country.
Do bulls potentially in some of those arid, dry states, do they talk less or more? About the same?
Depends
on the area, probably still.
It probably depends on the unit and how many permits there are and how much access and stuff. Because, I mean, if you look at like a 3A3C in Arizona, right, which is a highly coveted tag, and I think it's okay that I throw it out there, is, you know, being extremely hard to draw for archery, like those bulls rut their faces off, right?
Yeah.
Like they're really getting after it. I mean, same with some of those like 5B, you know, 5B North, 5B South, for a bunch of that similar type of country, and they rut really hard. I would think, you know, if it is hot, they may not be as active like during the middle of the day. You probably have the bulk of your bugling and your action like mid morning, early morning, and then late in the evening. So they might be a little bit quieter just based on the heat and how hot it is. But I still think if there's not an overabundance of pressure, they're still going to rut pretty hard. I've never hunted one of those units in New Mexico like that, but I know guys that have, and they still typically have a pretty good rut. Every elk hunt I've ever done in New Mexico, and I've hunted like your more traditional elk country, but there's always been a good rut.
Yeah.
Especially during that second season. You know, the tail end of the first season can be good, but that second season, it's like the heart of the rut. And if there's not just like every Tom, Dick, and Harry cruising around blowing hoochie mamas and bugles and stuff, I still think that they'll be rutting pretty hard, and I'd hunt them the exact same way as I'd hunt elk in Colorado. I'd just run and gun and bugle and just work on them, you know, just go at them.
Yeah.
Cut the distance, try to get within range, try to predict where they're going, try to predict where they're bedding. You know, mid-afternoons, I would hunt water sources, you know, because if you got downtime and you got nothing else going on and they're not talking, I'd camp out on a water source from 2:30, 3 in the afternoon till dark if there's nothing talking. Yeah, that's what I'd do.
Good advice.
Yeah, I don't know, man. Elk are easy, you know that. Okay, I got one for you. You ready?
Okay.
It's a mule deer question.
Really?
Yes.
I'm excited.
This is actually a good question, and I'm not even 100% sure how to answer this question, but I thought it was good, so that's why I threw it in here. It says, thoughts on mule deer hunting. There's big remote portions of the area that I have a tag for, but the best habitat looks like it's closer to roads and good access. How do I handle this situation?
So there's big and remote country in the unit that he has a tag for.
Big and remote. Yep. Definitely. Worse access, but it looks like the best habitat for deer is closer to roads and good access.
Do you say what season?
No.
Okay. Hopefully he's...
Take it from... I mean, would it matter?
Probably wouldn't matter. And also, are you looking at habitat in terms of actual mule deer habitat? Or are you looking at for like, is it for sure like browse? Or are we talking about?
It doesn't say, but let's assume that it is.
Okay, let's assume it's a good browse habitat in that time of year. And it's closer, you say closer to roads or access?
Closer to roads and good access. The best habitat looks like it's closer to roads and good access.
I mean, it's going to be a twofold approach. You're going to want to hunt both areas. Like,
which one would you start with?
Let's say you're showing up the day before the season. Day before the season, I might, if you have one day to scout, hopefully you do, check out some of those places that are right next to the road systems, the easier access spots. See if you can put some glass on it. See if you can find deer and that stuff. Obviously there probably will be deer there. Knowing that, not knowing what kind of pressure is, not knowing if those roads are easy to access, easy to glass from. So you could have a lot of people there, which could push deer animals away depending on the seasonality. I would probably still go into some of that remote country just to get away from people. Unless you're someone who maybe you want to run the roads and try to glass it that way. Like there's a two ways to approach it. If the habitat is good there's got to be good habitat in the remote areas too.
Yeah.
I mean, it is a tough one to answer because I don't know more about what it is, what time of season. Are we talking about archery? Are we talking about rifle? Is there rut impact? Because if there's rut and that's where the better habitat is, that's where the does are going to be. So then that's where the bucks potentially will be near too.
Right. As you move closer, like maybe till end of October, November. Yeah. Where the does are probably going to gravitate. Yeah. I mean, the does are going to gravitate towards the best feed. Right.
But if it's big and remote country too, and you're hunting an older deer, and if we're still, there's gotta be still habitat up there. That's a good chance to find a buck on your own terms to be able to glass it up, be able to work a situation, be able to figure out exactly where he's at, how to get close to it and how to shoot it.
As I was thinking about, so as you're talking, I'm thinking about deer that I've hunted over the years and that I've killed. And I'm thinking from a variety of seasons. So archery season, muzzleloader season, rifle season. And I'm thinking about habitat and quote unquote good habitat. And like the one thought that I keep having that's reoccurring is what is the best habitat for deer? Cause I found them all the way from the top, even late, you know what I mean? And I found them low, even when it's early on the archery hunt. Like I've killed deer low, like cedar sagebrush. Obviously it was good enough habitat to hold deer in August and September. And then, you know, late when you get into the rifle hunt, I've killed some bucks up in burns that I wouldn't necessarily look at and be like, oh, that is the best deer habitat. So it's hard. It's like it's hard to quantify, right? I feel like
deer are where they are, not where they think that you think they are.
Yeah. Yeah, that's interesting.
Because, yeah, you can look at a piece of habitat, too, and you could be like, oh, that's just a bunch of rocks. It's just a bunch of arid, open country. But, like, there can be a lot of deer sitting in that stuff. You're like, why would they go there? But that's
or
just
there could
their
be home. One deer, which is all you might all be looking for. You might be looking for, right? The caliber buck that you might be looking for might be hold up in, you know, some subpar habitat and just kind of making a living out there with what he can do because he has less pressure.
Yeah. How often, though, do you look at a spot and be like, that's the best habitat, and then you're going to go hunt the habitat? Or are you actually hunting more glassable country and looking into whatever it is, that's what it is?
Yeah, I think it's a thought. Like I'm thinking habitat, like when I'm looking at a map, it's usually when I'm doing e-scouting work, right?
Yeah.
I would say I probably spend more time thinking about things like pressure, like where's the pressure coming from? And then I also think more about how much country can I see from a given glassing point? And I would say probably as a third, maybe I'm thinking habitat.
Mm-hmm.
Is that
in
line with what you would say?
Yeah. Like when I'm trying to think of the question too, it's like, I don't really put a lot of my eggs into what are they going to be feeding on? It's more like, what country can I glass? Can I glass multiple different habitat types in a way? Mm-hmm. Like I want to be able to glass low country. I want to be able to glass middle elevations. I want to be able to glass high country. I want to be able to glass transition zone. I want to look at bedding areas. I want to be able to figure out, okay, here's some edge habitat where I think these deer could be in the timber, probably come out to the edge a little bit, kind of be able to glass them where they kind of feel safe. Never really worried about water too much unless it's the dry arid unit. So it's like, I kind of just want to be able to
glass a lot of country.
Glass a lot of country and glass it all, not focus just on one little spot.
Because
if I say that right now, if I want to focus on just habitat, they might not be in there that type of time of year on that habitat. They might be feeding on something else. Like,
yeah, habitat's hard. I mean, I feel like it's kind of hard with mule deer, to be honest. I feel like, you know, archery elk, I talk a lot about archery elk, but I feel like archery elk's a little bit more easier to pigeonhole, like what is quote unquote good habitat, right? Because you're talking big shady conifer, north facing, northeast facing slopes for bedding. You're talking benches, you're talking water. Like, I feel like it's a little bit easier to pinpoint. But mule deer, I mean, I've hunted bucks where, you know, I've been out looking, pulling cameras or something in July, and I've had a buck run across the road from me in the middle of the night. And I've been like, what the hell is he doing here?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And then I've gone back and it's an area that I would have never put a pin on a map to go in and glass. But then, you know, something happened. Either I thought, oh, I'm just going to go check it. I'm going to check water. Or like I said, I've had deer that have run across the road in the night and I've seen them and then gone back the next day or the next weekend. And I posted up and I've glassed that country. I killed a buck one time. I remember the reason I'm saying this is because I remember this happening, right? So I was going up on top of the mountain to a glassing point that I thought looked good. And I got off work late and drove up, and it was probably 11:30 midnight. I'm driving through low, low country sagebrush, and I have a group of bucks run across the road in front of me. And none of these bucks were like giant bucks, but I was like, shit, there's deer down here, right?
Mm-hmm.
So rather than going up, it was already late. I thought, oh, look at the map. Yeah, there's a glassing point I can hit. So I backed out. I went to it, hiked up on the knoll. I was there in the dark, waited for it to get light. And I ended up seeing, you know, mid-80s buck that ended up killing with a muzzleloader.
Mm-hmm.
But that buck was down in area. I would have never been like, yeah, that's a spot as far as habitat goes that I'm going to go look for that buck or a buck.
Yeah, and I was trying to think of like, so obviously I've had some muzzleloader tags. And, you know, I love hunting high country.
Mm-hmm.
I love that experience. But driving up in those places, I'm driving through tons of PJ, juniper type habitat. I see deer tracks across the road. I see deer tracks in that country and I'm leaving it to go up to the high country. It's like that habitat down there is still in that time of year just as potentially good as some of the high country stuff. There's still deer that just, that's their home.
Yeah.
And we all drive past them to go hunt a certain thing where you could be doing the opposite, trying to hunt quote unquote, not the best looking habitat. Cause in that case, you'd think the best habitat is the high country because that's potentially where the best groceries are.
Yeah.
But during that time of year too, there's still bucks that just love being down low in the PJs. That's their jam.
Yeah.
So like, I don't know, tough one to answer besides for if you can get some eyes on the country and maybe spend some time driving around and looking at the stuff that's close to a road. And then if there is enough animals there, hunt them.
It also depends on how many tags are available, right?
Mm-hmm.
So like if it's real busy, I don't think it's going to hold deer for very long. They'll get pressured and they'll move, right? So I would say it depends on how many permits there are. I think, yeah, start with habitat maybe. Start looking, you know, but I wouldn't spend too many days before I'd kind of peel off and I would start thinking about hunting pressure. I would start looking at areas that are receiving less hunting pressure,
mm-hmm.
depending on, you know, the number of permits and the time of year.
No.
That's a tough one.
It is a tough one. I don't know if he's mentioning too, like, is there private land nearby? That's the better habitat. Are you hunting kind of private public land borders?
Doesn't say.
Because you could still kind of do that, but you could also have bucks that just live on private the whole entire time and you keep spinning your wheels trying to hunt bucks that you hope have good habitat on the private and are going up into the public to bed.
I hate that game.
It's the worst.
Yeah, I
most
hate
most stressful situation.
I absolutely hate it. In fact, I'm at a point where if I see a deer or an antelope or whatever it might be and he's on private land, I just walk away from him because I'm like, you know what? I could spend the next week, 10 days, however I've got to hunt, and that animal could never leave that private property.
Yeah. And you add any sort of pressure around the area and you're definitely going to stay on the private.
Yeah, and I just sit there and look. I remember a buck we hunted on a third season Colorado hunt and big buck out in the field, same thing. We could go up there and sit there and look at him every single day. He'd be out in that field and you'd think, maybe he'll cross. Those are like days that I could have just spent out combing public land and hopefully come up with something, you know,
mm-hmm.
that it just sucks to sit there and longingly look at an animal.
Yeah.
Yeah, that can be hard. I'd say start close, give it a good look, but I wouldn't spend too much time. I would probably identify your glassing points and then... Yeah, I would think probably more about hunting pressure than I would about habitat, to be honest, and glassing. All right, what do you got?
This one will probably be a pretty quick one, but it's actually one I get quite a bit. I post a lot of Instagram stories or you hear me talking about it all the time. I really don't post all the stuff I eat because it kind of gets boring, but I post a lot of me eating bear meat.
Yeah, you do.
I have a lot of bear meat.
Mm-hmm.
Usually shoot a bear every single year.
I had antelope tacos the other night that were fantastic.
My guy.
They were great. Really good.
Speaking of tacos real quick, when we're on the subject of this, because every time I make, because this question is from Destin, I believe your name is. I'm sorry if I got that wrong. How do you season your ground bear meat?
Mm-hmm.
So we're talking about ground bear meat. But when you said tacos right there, I recently got turned on by Wilson and Lindsay, mm-hmm. our friends from Montana. Of, I don't know if the term is correct, raw tortillas.
Yeah,
it's basically the uncooked tortillas,
yeah,
and you
gotta the best.
Throw them on a cast iron.
Oh, for sure. Hands down, the best. Way better than other tortillas.
Where has that been my whole entire life?
I've been on that bus for 5 years, probably.
Yeah, so the girlfriend and I, when we went up to Montana, we stopped and stayed at their place for quite a few days. And then I got introduced to that. So I was like, oh, wow, I got to do that when mm-hmm. I get home. So now my new thing is all my ground meat, because I make burritos all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just ground meat. Basmati rice and maybe some hot sauce. Oh, definitely hot sauce, some pepper. And then now these new tortillas. Like,
you don't put any seasoning? Taco seasoning?
No.
Nothing.
No.
Just ground beef, salt, pepper?
Pepper.
Just pepper.
Yeah. And maybe if I have some cheese laying around, but usually I don't eat cheese. So I throw that up in a burrito. But when the question is, so how do you season your meat?
Mm-hmm.
So that's what I'd. Most of my meat, when I grind it, I already season it during the grinding process.
Oh, you do?
Yeah. So like my ground bear meat is already seasoned, so I don't need to add taco seasoning. You obviously could add it on top of it.
What do you put in it when you grind it?
So when I grind my ground bear meat, I usually use at least 5 or 10% bacon ends and pieces. So it's always like, basically it's bacon, but it's just ends and pieces. You can usually get cheaper. You can buy it in bulk because it usually comes in like these 3 or 4 pound bags.
Yep.
And then when I'm grinding it, so after the first grind of doing everything, the bear meat and then the bacon and pieces, and my final grind before I put it into these like 1 pound or 2 pound little meat bags, I season it with sage seasoning.
Okay.
Sometimes I'll use something else like some breakfast seasoning or whatever, but usually almost, I would say 75% of all my wild game meat is seasoned with sage seasoning. And I feel like that's the ticket.
So you just put just sage.
Just sage seasoning.
No pepper, no salt.
Nope. Until I cook it, and then I might add some salt or pepper on top of it.
Okay.
But like, that's basically all my ground bear meat. And I love just that sage seasoning, bacon ends and pieces, toss it on whatever sort of grill thing. I recently got a new grill, so I've been cooking with that a little bit.
Yeah, I saw that.
I think it's pretty sick.
Yeah.
It's well worth it.
I saw that. I don't have one yet. I don't do any seasoning when I do the grind. That's interesting.
Yeah, because the only downside is then it's already flavored like that. So if you wanted to like do something different, like, oh, I want to make spaghetti with it. Well, now all my stuff is seasoned with sage, which is not a bad flavor for that at all. And you can still add taco seasoning, and then that's going to overpower the other seasoning in there. But I feel like it adds a good flavoring to it. So almost like I'm making sausage every time. But I still make burgers out of that. Like my deer will have sage seasoning in it. I just like the sage the best. Like when I try to do other things and it being like too sweet or too overpowering. I mean, obviously, you know, certain animals will do different. Sometimes make chorizo, sometimes make other things. But like that sage, elk, mule deer, antelope, they all get sage. Bear gets sage.
I've never done that. I do the bacon ends. I'll do cut bacon ends. And I'll do it with all my grind, whether it's mule deer, elk, or antelope, or whatever it might be. Oddad. I did some bacon ends, but then I just season it when I cook it, and it's usually just salt, pepper, maybe some onion powder or garlic powder, maybe. Taco seasoning, something like that. But,
It's not like a direct question, but I get all the time, is bear meat actually good? And I'm like, when I make it this way, obviously there's at least, you know, 5 to 10% bacon ends and pieces. And you have bear meat, and then I have the sage seasoning, and then, you know, make sure you cook it long enough, which I just cook it till it's like black. Almost black.
You don't do temperature.
Temperature anymore. I've tried it before, but now I kind of have a gauge. Like, I'm just going to cook it over top. And that's why I just make burritos out of it.
Is it crunchy?
A little bit crunchy.
Really? A little bit crunchy.
But like the burrito side of it, to me, oh, it's so good having bear burritos.
The other night when we cooked antelope burger, we did burritos. I told you already, but my oldest kid was sitting there. He was eating, I think he had like 3 or 4 of them. But I asked him, I said, do you know what kind of meat that is you're eating? And he's like, nope, not a clue. And I was like, you really don't have any idea. And he's like, nope. He's like, I wouldn't know. He's like, we do elk, we do mule deer, we do antelope. And he's like, on any given night, it could be whatever it is. He's like, beef. He's like, I couldn't tell you the difference. He's like, we don't ever eat beef. Like, I don't ever do. I have one packet of beef burger in my fridge, but I would say in the last 20 some years, I can't remember us ever buying like beef. Right. Yeah. And he's just like, I got no clue. He's like, it's burger. It tastes great. He couldn't tell the difference. Didn't know what it was. I was like, well, if you had to guess, what would you think it is? And he's like, I don't know, maybe mule deer. And I was like, no, that's antelope. And he's like, yeah, I couldn't tell you. He's like, we eat all kinds of elk, deer, and antelope usually.
Speaking of the same subject, do you feel like since we have wild game so much, then the times when, like, I'm the same as you, I'd never buy beef. I'd never go buy steaks. I'd never buy ground. But every now and then my girlfriend.
She'll buy a steak.
She'll buy some ground.
Oh, okay.
Some ground beef. And then we have that and we make that into burritos or whatever else. And I eat that just in a burrito and I don't know what it is. I can totally tell it's beef and I'm not sure I like.
Yeah, I can tell.
I'm not sure I like it. It tastes like sweeter or like more, I don't know. It just tastes different. I like the wild game taste so much. I just think it's better than having beef.
Yeah.
Like beef, like a beef steak. Okay, that's. I
like a beefsteak.
Like you're talking about T-bone or something?
Yeah, absolutely.
Tastes really good. But when it's ground, I don't know. I'm just...
Yeah, me either.
It doesn't taste as good as like a ground elk. I'd rather have ground elk all day long over like a ground
beef. I really like antelope burgers, like an actual burger.
Do you put like blue cheese and avocado when you're doing it? That's how you make a really good antelope burger.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, I like all the fixings. Yeah. Yeah, cheese.
Egg on top?
No egg.
Throw a fried egg, some blue cheese.
I don't do fried avocado. Fried egg on a burger, but I'll do.
Come on, Trail. You haven't lived.
I'll do cheese. I like avocado. Yeah, ketchup, mustard, maybe some lettuce, a tomato. Like, I love that for sure. Yeah, antelope burgers for whatever reason.
It's always been one of my favorites.
They hit home antelope for me. Yeah. I've got that antelope in the freezer. Like, I haven't eaten a backstrap off of it yet, but it's like on the to do list here pretty quick. Maybe this week, huh? That's a good one. Question, you ready for another one?
Yeah.
Okay. This guy says, I have a Montana Breaks deer hunt in November. I'm torn on what puffy I should get. What's going to be warm enough? He mentioned the Grumman. He mentioned the Sitka Kelvin, light, I believe. Are those going to be warm enough, or how do you approach a puffy for a late season hunt?
That's a tough one because you're going to need more than that. The puffy's not going to be your end all be all.
Yeah, the Grumman's a really nice down jacket. It's really lightweight. It's super packable. stuff's down next to nothing, but I don't think that that can be like your standalone insulation layer for a October, November style hunt.
Yeah, you're on hunting any of that type of country, you're going to need a base layer. Obviously, you're going to need a midweight layer. Sometimes you need a heavyweight, like fleece type layer. And then you're going to probably want to have a down jacket with you. And then you potentially going to want to have a soft shell as well on top of it to start blocking the wind. And I mean, stacking hoods kind of gets annoying, but the more hoods, I kind of cater that to like the temperatures of them hiking around. Cause trying to sit out there in glass when it's 10, 15 degrees, the wind's always blowing. Where are you going to have to glass during that country? You're gonna have to glass into the wind, because where those bucks are going to be, they're going to be bedded on the side that's not in the wind. So you have to face the wind to be able to glass them. So you're going to get rocked by cold temperatures constantly. And then you're probably be sitting in the snow. It's probably gonna be cold. So yeah, you like a puppy's going to be great. And I do think either of those two options are going to be phenomenal. But again, you're going to have to combo it with a bunch of other layers, and it's going to be catered to you. Sometimes I even wear two puffies.
Yeah.
You know, I'll wear a synthetic puffy, then I'll wear a down puffy.
So let me ask you a question. Is your answer to that question essentially that you should layer? So you should use layers rather than just getting like your traditional base layer, mid layer, and then like a really heavy duty down jacket. So is your preference to layer like base layer, mid layer, maybe another insulation layer, then a puffy, then maybe a soft shell?
Yep. I would rather do multiple layers like that, because then it sets you up for other hunts in the future. So you could take that mid layer, have it with the, you know, maybe just the soft shell. You could have a mid weight and then maybe like a piece like a Cirque light jacket or a Cirque from Stone Glacier. And like that way you can multiply out your hunts and have gear for a lot of different hunting situations. But if you just had a base layer, a midweight layer, a puffy, then like a really heavy, like a parka jacket or something like that. Like that's only specifically catered to one style of hunt, maybe like a truck style hunt. You're not going to want to pack that in the backcountry. So I think if you have multiple layers, yes, it's going to be a little bit more expensive to have a lot of different layers, because all these things are, you know, they cost money. But then I think you're more well set up for changing conditions, especially when you're moving around. Like when you're moving around that type of country, yeah, it's going to be cold when you're sitting there, but you move, you're going to want to ditch a lot of that stuff so you don't start sweating. Because what's the worst thing?
Yeah,
hunting in November is sweating, and then sitting down again and all your layers are, you know, you sweat it through.
Yeah, wet and warm is okay. Cold and wet's not good.
Yeah. So I would rather have more layers, and that's why usually in the late season hunting, do bring a bigger backpack, even if I'm just day hunting. Because I want to be able to stuff all those layers in there and just have multiple options. Someday you might not need it. You can mix and match all that stuff, leave stuff at the truck.
Yeah.
But that way I think you're more set up for what you get thrown at you.
Yeah, I would agree. I don't think there's anything wrong with getting a Grumman style jacket, like that weight, that amount of fill for a late season hunt, but realize you're going to end up having to stack layers on layers on layers and to provide like the overall warmth. The one note like I did have is like if really you're only hunting, you know, late season stuff, the hyper down jacket from Sitka I think is a nice option. I don't have that jacket, but I've got the down pants, the hyper down pants, which are super puffy.
Yeah.
Really, really warm. I just pulled the specs on that. So it has 230 grams of 800 fill power Primalov gold down blend. It's 1 pound, 4.6 ounces. So it's not terrible, to be honest. You're 20 and a half ounces, which isn't terrible for a jacket. So it's as warm as it is. The only real stinger for that is it's $550, it looks like, which is not cheap by any means. But if you wanted a really warm jacket, and then maybe you wouldn't have to have quite so many layers to get the warmth, you could probably go that route, which would be kind of in the wheelhouse for what my recommendation might be.
Yeah, that'd actually be a good one. Then you can maybe ditch some of those midweight or heavyweight type pieces, and then have a base layer, obviously have that, and then maybe still a soft shell.
Yeah, I'm like you though. I just typically layer up. Yep. Ended up using like a Grumman as my exterior insulation layer, and then maybe a soft shell over the top of it, or a hard shell like you know, a rain jacket or something like that, just to buck the wind, something with some wind stopper in it.
Yep.
Yeah. Okay. Good one. I like that one. Late season hunts, I hate them. That's why I hate them, because it's the damn cold. There's the damn cold. I hate being cold.
Bro, I was,
you know what? I hate being hot too. I'd rather be cold than hot, but I hate cold late hunts. Man, those are rough.
So I was sitting out there helping Lorenzo last couple of days, and no joke, it was like 105 out in the middle of the day. And I'm trying to glass this one spot from a different angle to try to see if we can find our target buck bedded in some weird spot, because sometimes it moves in the middle of the day and we just can't pick him up. And no joke, no shade anywhere. I'm just sitting there, just sweating out of every single part that I didn't know I could sweat from.
Yeah.
To keep it slightly PG. I got up off my glassing pad and I had a sweat stain.
Oh yeah.
From my ass on the glassing pad. It was so hot and it was like dripping everywhere. Like I can feel it on my neck. I can feel it, you know, all over the place. My legs sweating.
Uh-huh.
I was like, my gosh, I can't wait for late season.
I hate cold fingers and cold toes.
I know, but like in the early season though, I can't just glass there in my shorts and flip flops.
Yeah, I know.
I have to have pants on, yeah, which the pants true. Are kind of hot. And then you have any sort of base layer, no matter what base layer it is, when it's 100 degrees in the sun,
mm-hmm.
you're going to be pretty hot and you're going to be sweaty.
You know, I think one of the worst feelings for me is like you have a late season hunt. Maybe it's a third rifles tag in Colorado or something, right? And you have the spot you want to get to. So you're just absolutely busting your ass to get up there to it. And you're sweating. I mean, you're sweating. And then you get up to your spot. It's before light. And it's always that half hour before light, right? Before the sun crests is always the coldest part of the day, right? And you're right there at your glassing point and you're like peeling off your wet layers to try to replace them with some dry layers out of your backpack. And then you sit down and like that cold sets in. Yeah. Oh, I hate that. My feet feel just numb. My hands get tingly. I hate that. I hate
boxers are sweaty.
Oh, I hate that cold weather.
And then that first point, we have to expose your skin when you're stripping down, like getting rid of that base layer to throw in your backpack with some other stuff or put underneath some other clothes to let it dry out. Like, yeah, that ain't fun.
I'm a big fan of those late season hunts of packing an extra base layer to peel off the one that's wetted out.
Yeah.
And that's usually like when I get up to a glassing point, that's the first thing I do is peel off my base layer and replace it with a dry one and then layer up over the top of it. And I've been pretty, I mean, not blown away. I don't think it's like going to blow anybody's mind, but in like instantly you're a lot warmer just because you got a dry top on.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. All right. What do you got?
Okay. This one's going to be a dual hit. You'll hear me say it afterwards. This one's from Garrett on Instagram.
Garrett in the warehouse?
No, but instantly I wrote down. I thought of that too.
All right.
So it's not from Garrett in the warehouse. But
shout out Garrett. Garrett does an awesome job, by the way. Garrett's a good dude.
Dude, you see his beard is always...
It's epic. Yeah. He's always got a knife hanging around his neck on the cord. And dude, that guy, every time I talk to him, he's like, or see him in the warehouse, like that guy's just head down, just busting his ass.
Yeah, he's got some tags this year too, I heard.
That's awesome.
Yeah. So this guy's like, hey man, are the Zulu 6 HDX Pros from Sig Sauer worth the extra cost over the smaller sized HDX non-pros? I see you using them a lot, so I figured you'd have some good insight.
I've answered this question no less than 20 times in the last month and a half.
Okay. So I'll be excited to hear your thoughts on it.
Yeah, I can tell you what I...
Okay, so let's go with yours first. What would be your suggestion between the two? So let's say whatever magnification, compare magnification to magnification on the two. What would be your consideration?
So how I've been answering this question is I like the original version better.
Okay.
My opinion is based on the fact that I think they're lighter. So they are lighter.
They are lighter. I think comparing straight 16s, so the regular HDX 16x42s, they are 1 pound, basically 6 ounces.
Okay.
And the pros in the 16, which are 50 mil objective, are 2 pounds, 2 ounces. So that's what, 12, 12-ish?
6, 10, yeah.
12-ounce difference.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a lot.
Yeah, it's quite a bit.
Yeah.
So I like the originals based on the fact that they're lighter. Two, seems like the battery life is longer.
Okay.
To me, and I don't own the HD. Like I don't own the second version.
You don't own the pros.
Yeah. So I will say that I've played with them. I've used them. I looked through yours. You know, the guys from Sig, I've looked through them, but seems like the battery life is better. Seems like they're lighter. They're smaller. So they're more compact and they only require one battery versus two.
Mm-hmm.
And then as far as magnification goes, we might disagree here, but I've been telling everybody my very favorite, and it is my favorite, is the 12s. I like the 12 over the 16 or the 10. The 10s are a 10x32. The 16s are a 16x42. The 12s are a 12x42. So those relationships, right, is what you determined your exit pupil, which is the amount of light that they gather and the brightness essentially that it's going to give you. So the 12x42, in my opinion, you get enough magnification that you can glass. You can, they're great for mule deer. They're great for elk. They're great for antelope. They're great for spot and stock. They're not like so magnified that like when you get within 50 yards and stuff that they're kind of annoying. Your field of view is smaller and mm-hmm. they're brighter dawn and dusk. So I've been telling people the original version, 12 by 42. That's my advice. Which is the right answer.
Wow, we're going to have an argument here.
What's your opinion?
Okay. So I do like everything you said.
Mm-hmm.
Totally agree. The HDX, the original ones, it is really nice the size that they are.
Mm-hmm.
So you're getting a smaller footprint on your bino harness. You potentially could have a smaller size bino harness. That's mm-hmm. a great piece of it. Okay. I will disagree with you till the end of time, though, and I will fight this forever.
Tooth and nail.
Tooth and nail on your choice of the 12s or the 16s.
I know, and we fundamentally disagree about this. So I know that.
No matter, I believe, which model you get, the HDX or HDX Pros, the size are the same between the 12s and the 16s, and the weight is the same between the 12s and 16s. It's like
yeah.
a half ounce difference.
Sure.
So for the same weight.
Mm-hmm.
You could just get more power.
But they're not as bright.
That is true. Okay. So that is why then, if you're going to compare the HDX between the HDX Pros, if you're looking for low light performance and you want something that's going to perform then, that's when I would steer you towards the HDX Pro.
So the 16 by 50?
16 by 50, because you get a mm-hmm. little bit more light gathering with the 50 mil. The double battery... I believe their estimated runtime, don't quote me on it, I think it's 40-some hours
I don't know
on the battery
sure.
time of that. Mm-hmm. But that is the problem, though. You have to carry two batteries.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to carry two batteries, so that's extra weight you have to carry on top of that, okay? And then changing two batteries, well, it seems like it's really easy. Oh, you just got to unscrew one, you got to unscrew the other. But like, okay, that's time when like when the batteries are going to go out, it's going to be when you're glassing something and you're like, frantically yeah. need to get your battery swapped.
Mm-hmm.
So being able to change one battery is a lot quicker and a lot easier. I literally had to do it on Lorenzo's hunt. I was like literally watching a buck move around and I was like, shit.
I've never packed an extra battery for mine. I changed it out prior to a hunt and I just, I'm like, yep, good to go yeah. for the next 10 days or whatever it might be.
So the part though I struggle with when I...
The glass is better in the HD.
HDX Pros.
The HDX Pros. I will say the glass
yep.
is better.
The glass does seem, yep, is, I would
it's
agree
clearer,
it's better. Yep, it's
sure.
a lot clearer, brighter, all that.
Yep.
When I am hand-holding them, I do agree that the regular HDX feels a little bit better in my hand because it's a little more tighter in form factor.
Yeah.
But I've gotten used to the HDX Pro, obviously, with the two battery compartments. So it does feel like I can manipulate my hands to hold mm-hmm. them really easy. When I have told people the difference between this, some depends on what you're kind of looking for. If you're on a backcountry hunt and trying to save a little weight, that's why the HDX are great. If you're not concerned about low light, because maybe you have a big spotter with you, you can get by with that. The one thing I will say fully, I like the scan and target modes on the original HDX more than the newer, which I believe is the Omni Scan
mm-hmm.
on the HDX Pro. So the HDX Pros has something built into it where it's basically the slower you move your binos, it's going to change the basically the stabilization based on like how much you're moving, shaking, that sort of thing. So it goes in between them.
Mm-hmm.
I like the original one where you have to flip the switch, you know, once you turn it on, turn it off and turn it back on within a couple seconds to engage the target mode. So that's the higher stabilization mode. I like that better.
Mm-hmm.
Because I like to switch that into that a lot when I'm just really trying to focus on things I don't care about. If it's windy out or my hands are moving, I like that. I like to force it into the other mode. So that's why I really like that one. I will say, depending on the hunt, like if I know I'm hunting, you know, like my tag this year, okay, it's hot. It's going to be hot in October.
Mm-hmm.
So I am going to need low light performance. So that's
sure.
where for that hunt, I'm keeping the HDX Pros in my hand.
The 16 by 50s.
16 by 50s. But on some of my other hunts I'm going on where I don't need that, where I want that scan mode, I'm going to be using just the regular HDX, the 16 by 42.
Will you yield that the 12 is a more versatile magnification?
No.
There's
never a time.
Like if you're hunting whitetail, you're hunting antelope, you're hunting mule deer, you're hunting elk.
Why would I hunt whitetail? Just kidding.
It's more versatile.
I do get that, but there's never a time when I wished I had 12. There's always a time when I wish I could see a little bit more country.
There's definitely times that I'm glad I don't have
16. There is a downside. Yes, you're in the tight canyon. All right. I have to grid out more and scan more.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. But when it comes to just wanting to really see that animal and fully analyze it really quickly, that 16 is great. And I don't have to mount it on a tripod. So if I carried a 12, I kind of wish I had some 15s on a tripod then.
Mm-hmm.
Which I have to carry two optics.
Yeah.
The 16 means I can get rid of a lower magnification 12, which I used to always carry 12 by 50s, sure, mounted on a tripod. Means I can now ditch the 15s, just carry one piece of optic. I can add any sort of thing from Asiac or Tricer as a tripod adapter and mount it on a tripod and grid.
Mm-hmm.
And while it was this last week, I was using the HDX Pros mounted on my tripod with stabilization off because I just don't want to burn my battery right now. And I can literally just grid out the terrain so I don't have to use the stabilization and mm-hmm. mount it on a tripod. But 16s are just superior in every way. Antelope hunting, 16s all day.
Yeah, that one I could maybe make. It depends on the season too, though. I mean, bow hunting elk.
Okay,
like,
maybe we should say it. Okay, maybe I'll agree with you here.
Bow hunting mule deer.
We're going to compromise.
Okay.
If you're bow hunter only and you are carrying a spotter, I'll put that out there.
Yep.
The 12s will be great for bow hunting because we're in the stock.
Yep.
It's going to be perfect. Archery elk hunting. Even if you don't have a spot or whatever, maybe the 12s are going to be great because you're going
to
be in the timber.
You're looking usually through like lodgepole pine or conifer, and you're just trying to like pick up hide and body, and 16's like too much.
Okay, I'll compromise you there. But if you're a rifle guy,
maybe
16's all day.
Maybe
16's all day for either of them.
I will agree though. If you go to the 16s, I think the HDX Pros or with the 50mm is probably a better bet, in my opinion. That's a good one.
And then Cam from New Zealand.
Yeah.
So he's obviously used mine when he came out on my brother's elk hunt, and I let him borrow the normal HDX, those 16x42s. I obviously had my pros there as well, and he was checking out those. He asked to place an order for those, and I brought them over to him because obviously it's harder to ship.
Mm-hmm.
So he asked me which ones to get, and then based on what he was using and what his use case is, he didn't need low light performance. He wanted packability, lightweight, the single battery thing. So he ended up going with the HDX, the original one.
16x42s.
Yep, 16x42s. And that was perfect for him. So I think it's situational. Depends on what you're hunting. Depends your style, bow, rifle, maybe.
Mm-hmm. And again, I haven't used the HDX Pros that much. Everything I've used is the original version, and I like them in a 12. But
I will say, though, I don't know if the right word, unequivocally, whatever, I just messed that up. Stabilization is king.
For sure.
I can't go back.
Yeah.
I can't go back.
Yeah, it's pretty great.
Can't. And it's not because they sponsor the podcast, whatever it is. I can't go back.
Mm-hmm.
I love the features of it.
Mm-hmm.
I've even tested the NL Pures last year, the 14s, when they came out. We had a test pair here. I probably could have, begged and pleaded and probably kept them for myself.
Mm-hmm.
I gave them back.
I mean, I have a pair of Leica Noctavid 10x42s, which I used for years and years, which I don't think most people could say there is much, maybe the pure, maybe for the right, the individual's eyes.
Mm-hmm.
But it's hard to say that there's a set of glass in the world that is as clear, bright as that those are.
Yeah.
And I'm still using the SIGs.
The features are what are for me are going to help me find an animal and kill an animal.
Yeah.
Yes, big, bright glass has its place for sure. Low light conditions.
Yeah.
But that stabilization allows me just to run around. When it's windy, hiking up something, I'm breathing heavy, I can pull them out, see an animal.
Yeah, they're great. Yep. You ready for next one?
Ready for next one. Sorry, I got long-winded.
No, you're good. That was a good one.
I just wanted to argue with you for a little bit.
No, that's a good one. Oh. So here's an antelope question. So we've got archery antelope. They've already kind of kicked off in Nevada, I guess, early, but there's definitely a bunch of units that don't kick off until or maybe the 14th, I want to say. And then Utah, I think they kick off this coming Saturday.
Montana, the 15th of August. Yeah, I think Colorado's right the same thing.
Yeah, most states it's middle of August. And then you've got your rifle hunts that are kind of piggybacking on the backside of those, muzzleloader hunts if you got states that have those hunts. But this guy asked me, how far do you think antelope travel from water? So I don't know. I did some looking.
Okay.
So I'm going to say, based on what I found on the internet, It says papers, and then the different sources that I looked at said that they suggest maybe 5 miles. 5 miles feels like too much to
me. 5 miles feels like a lot. I've always said like within 2 or 3 miles.
I'm going to even say within a mile, mile and a half, to be honest. Like almost all the antelope I've ever killed have been within, I would say, a mile of a water source that they're pretty reliant upon and using. Has that been your experience?
Yeah, I would say that's a better estimate. Obviously, you see them further, but like then they're usually probably creeping to another water source maybe you don't know about. But if you stick with, if I find a water source and there's water on it, mm-hmm. you could probably guess within a mile around there's going to be an antelope.
Yeah, when I read that today, I was like, shit, 5 miles? That's a long ways.
5 miles is
way too
much.
Dude, 5 miles and a lot of that antelope country is a long ways.
Yeah.
Big, flat, open. And I'm not saying they couldn't. They certainly could, but I'm just saying all the antelope I've ever hunted, I would say, have been within a mile mm-hmm. of a water source that they've been hitting.
So stick with a mile.
Okay. All right, what do you got?
Ooh, this is a good one. I'll get into it. I'm going to do this one right now. It's, okay, okay. It is a good one.
Okay.
Could be a little controversial. Here we go. It's from Matthew.
Mm-hmm.
With two T's. Matthew with two T's.
From Matthews.
Yeah. I know this is a complicated question. So already when you start right there, you know it's going to be one of those good ones. No, this is a complicated question. I will apologize to this guy too. He did hit me up twice.
Oh, yeah.
The same sort of question.
Hopefully, he listens to this.
I know. I probably should DM him and say, hey, we covered on the podcast. That's why I wrote his name down. So I know this is a complicated question, but would you consider the 6.8 Western a great round for elk?
I don't know a ton about it other than my. So I'll play the opposite side of the coin because I know you and I know you like 300. So I'm going to assume you're going to say no. That's just my gut assumption. My brother has one and loves it, and he shot elk.
Oh, did I give him that one?
Yeah. He likes it a lot, and he shot cow elk with it pretty consistently and had great results.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm going to say maybe.
Okay, and that's where I'm going to slightly agree with you again.
Uh huh.
But he said a great round. He didn't just say will it work. He said would you consider the 6.8 Western a great round for elk? So if you're going to say great round, I will say to him, it can be a great round for elk,
mm-hmm.
but you got to understand limitations on that for elk.
What's the limit?
It's going to definitely be correct bullet selection.
Mm-hmm. Grain.
It's going to be, I mean, just depends on if you're trying to do like a hybrid target type bullet or you're trying to do something that's going to expand a lot more. You can go copper, you can go lead. Both of them can be great, but just like trying to figure out what it could be. I'd prefer, you know, there's a lot of great options out there, but to shoot something that's very accurate. And then also you've maybe tested that same sort of bullet on an animal before, but like more important than that, that's a very important part about it. But you'd have to want to keep in mind distance and then shot selection.
Okay. What kind of distance are we talking?
I would say, again, it's going to can go back and forth on it. But if you can keep your shots under 350 yard-ish, it could be a great round as long as you realize, too, you want to make sure that it's the ideal conditions.
Mm-hmm.
So the nice thing about shooting something bigger, which I would prefer in this situation, is no one is perfect.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? No one can judge wind. Even on like a 300 yard shot, you could still have some wind or some environmentals, or you could be really excited, or the animal might take a step. Okay, so if that animal takes a step and I'm shooting a larger gun with a correct bullet again, the odds of that bull just standing there and mm-hmm. taking it in and be like, oh, that hurt. Like when I shoot things with the 300 Rum, 300 Win Mag, 200 plus grain bullets, hand loaded, mm-hmm. shooting really high feet per second. And that's not everything, but just quality components. That bull stands there and it's like, ooh, ouch.
Mm-hmm.
Break a bunch of bones, do something. That animal's not going to run away on me. So I can get a second shot. And now you could argue the opposite because, okay, the recoil is going to impact it. It's going to be harder to get a second shot. You might get off target really quickly, but with practice, you can start to, you know, understand how to work the system. Whereas you shoot something with a smaller caliber cartridge combo, you shoot something once, it might just run. Okay, now you're not going to be able to get a second shot on it because you hit it in the shoulder by accident. You hit it somewhere where it's not going to be fully lethal, doesn't have, I don't know, just you have to be mindful of your shot selection and distance, I think, more when you try to do lesser stuff. And yes, there's people that argue this till the end of the time about like they try to pick the smallest cartridge possible to go hunt moose, and like, sure, it works.
Let me pose a question to you. Let's say you had a 6.8 Western mm-hmm. with 165 grain bullet.
Okay.
It's really accurate. Really accurate. It's a tac driver.
Tac driver.
You have a 300, 200 grain plus bullet.
Okay.
It's not, it's accurate, but it's not as accurate as mm-hmm. your 6.8.
I see where you're going here.
Which one are you taking?
On an elk.
Yeah.
Yeah. What distance?
400 yards.
400 yards. Really accurate versus not very accurate.
I mean, it's accurate. It's just not as accurate. It's just not grouping like you'd like it to, the 300. Whereas your 6.8 is just, you're shooting just nice groups.
On an elk, I'm still going to go big.
Really? Even though it might be a smidge less accurate?
Might be a smidge less accurate. I'm going to go big. I just don't want to leave chance. I value animals' life so much.
Yeah, and but if it's less accurate.
I know, but it's less accurate too. Like, why are you forcing me to take the shot then? I don't know. It's that whole fixed blade versus mechanical, yeah, heavy versus light argument where they are both technically probably always correct. And again, if you can shoot a lighter weight thing and it doesn't have much recoil and you can get off multiple shots really quickly and get on target right away, that's going to be a great benefit.
Mm-hmm.
But again, there hasn't been a lot of times where I've shot something with a big gun and hit it somewhere and it's literally like ran off. Usually it's like, oh my gosh, and I can instantly get back on it and take another shot.
Yeah, fills it, right?
So you can. And like I said, like I'm taking, I was going to use a 6.8 Western on my mountain goat hunt.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to take a 6.5 PRC.
Mm-hmm.
I have a 300 RUM, I have a 300 Win Mag, I have a 7 PRC. Like,
yeah.
I'm doing that because I'm selecting the right bullet combination for it. I'm limiting my distance on my mountain goat.
It's lighter.
It's going to be lighter. It's mm-hmm. a very light platform I'm taking. So it's like, you know, I'm trying something different, mm-hmm. but I still understand where I have to shoot that animal. I'm not mm-hmm. going to be like, okay, I'm just going to, you know, shoot right in the shoulder like I would in my rum. I'm probably going to, you know, go back and shoot in the heart lung area and understand that I can get multiple shots off quickly. And if I have to take multiple shots on an animal, there shouldn't be anything that people should hate on you for. In a sense, as long as you're making good quality shots and it's not a distance factor.
Mm-hmm.
Like if the animal's still standing there, always shoot it again. Bow, rifle, whatever it is. Like even if it's a 223 and for some reason you're shooting, you know, a whitetail or a mule deer with something super lightweight, wherever it's legal in your state. And if you can get four shots on it and that's what you can do because it's still standing there, shoot four times.
So your final answer is it's a good round. It's not a great elk gun.
But if you literally want one gun to do it all and like you understand things, do it. Just understand, shoot it a lot. Understand how it works. Try out different bullets. Shoot some animals with different bullets to maybe feel out what's working for you, what's not. Like
good deer gun, good deer gun, good elk gun under maybe 300 yards.
Yeah, I mean
350.
Like,
you feel like?
I mean, I don't like talking distance for a lot, but like we've killed a mule deer with the 6.8 Western. It was like 620 yards.
Mm-hmm.
Dropped dead.
Right.
Like, yeah, crushed it.
Yeah,
it's a great round. It's just understanding what you're shooting at and also realizing that what's at the end of that is an animal. Mm-hmm. So don't push the boundaries. And that's why I lean more towards the bigger side, because when you're out in the field, no matter what kind of ethics, moral guidelines you have, if you have a target animal that you're like really excited about, or it's the biggest deer you've ever seen, biggest elk you've ever seen, like the chances of you maybe pushing your boundaries a little bit are probably a little bit greater because you're in that situation.
Mm.
You have 2 days left of the season. It's now at 400 yards and you mainly only shot something a little bit closer before. Gosh, it might be nicer to have that bigger gun. I'm not saying you should ever push it, but I've seen it more often than not. People are like, oh, I'm comfortable at this. I'm like, really? Yeah. Are you?
That's hard, man. That's a hard one. Because, I mean, ideally you have your boundaries and you stick to them, right? But...
And setting up a gun is
easier said than done.
Setting up a gun is expensive. Like if you have a rifle and you want to choose one for everything, you have to put an optic on it. You have to, you know, get ammo for it. You have to get a bipod for it. Obviously bipod, you can swap between guns, but like, it's kind of like one of those things though, where you might have to have, you know, different sleeping bags for different conditions. You want to maybe have a different rifle for different animals,
mm-hmm.
or again, just have fun and understand you have to get closer, which is a great thing.
Yeah.
Cause I use a muzzle loader because I have to get closer.
Sure.
But definitely a rifle is probably way more ethical and way more accurate. Mm-hmm. Which is fun to understand that you have to get in tight. And she definitely right. Cheats your shot placement.
All right. Good, not great.
Good, not great.
Okay. I'm gonna wrap this one into maybe a two-part question. So this guy says, my local bow shop's always so slammed. Where do I start if I want to get into doing some of my own work at home? And I think you could extrapolate that and say the same thing about if you're wanting to get into maybe like reloading, like mm-hmm. what are the first steps? So I guess from an archery perspective, I would say the easiest ways to get into doing some of your own stuff at home is probably with your arrows. So an arrow saw, you pick up an arrow saw, whether that's a mod saw or Weston. Those are nice little saws. What's the other one called? Man, it is afternoon. My mind's blanking right now. It'll come to me in a minute. But whatever the arrow saw is that you get, I think an arrow saw is a great start. So buy your own arrow saw, buy a fletching jig. So Bitsenberger fletching jig. Those are great places to start. So you can do your own arrows. You can cut them. You can glue in your inserts. You can fletch your own fletchings. I think that's a big load because that's a big time suck. Like if you're waiting for an archery shop to get your arrows built, it can be pretty long because those mm-hmm. take a long time to build. And it seems like everybody kind of stacks up and waits for, you know, a month out of the season. So they can certainly get busy. Above and beyond that, like I'm a big fan of buying your own press. So an Easy Press Green from Last Chance. So Last Chance is the arrow saw that I was talking about. The other one I just forgot the name of. But Last Chance, I mean, it's $400, right? It's not cheap, but it's not mm-hmm. super expensive either. And then granted that you'll end up using the thing for years and years and years, right? Until they come up with something that's easier or better. But I think it's relatively inexpensive. Once you jump up to a draw board, which I think is a great piece of equipment that you should have that goes with the Last Chance press, which those are not cheap either. I think you're probably going to, you know, be $700 probably for a press and a draw board. Draw board isn't absolutely necessary, but man, is it handy. I use it all the time for timing cams and just checking your arrow at full draw, checking knock pinch. But I would say press, and then as far as like getting started, there's tons of resources on YouTube. We've done resource like videos on how to set up a bow, how to build an arrow. I mean, there's a ton, like a metric ton of how to cut an arrow, how to fletch an arrow, how to build an arrow, and then bow tuning. So I've written articles that you can use for reference with big giant tables. It'll let you know like what the impact is if you twist a cable or twist a string or how you get your cams in time, whatever it might be. So I would say that's a great place to start. Start with your arrows. Mm-hmm. I'd say that's where most people start. And then depending on like how into archery you are, like if you're somebody that's trying to get the most out of your bow and arrow setup, like if you're trying to be as accurate as possible, you really enjoy shooting, you're shooting every day, you love bow hunting, buy a press. Like, and if you think you're going to be into it forever, go for it. I mean, buy one. I had a young couple from St. George. They came up and I put a new string on his bow. I tuned her bow. I spent probably 5.5-6 hours with them one evening on a Sunday. These guys are absolutely into it. Like, I mean, they go to local shoots. They shoot every day. They love shooting. I'm like, you guys are a prime candidate for buying a press. Mm-hmm. Like, you should buy a press.
Yeah.
You should buy a draw board, buy a press, be done with it. You're going to be so much better off in the long term because then you can play with little things like, what does an eighth of an inch of my draw length feel like?
Yeah.
What? How does that make me aim? Cam timing, you know?
Mm-hmm.
What if I advance my cam a little bit? How does that hold? What's the back wall feel like? You know, all those things that you can only do with a press or a draw board. So I would say if you're really into it, just bite the bullet and do it. Put it on a credit card.
Yes.
That's what I would say. But what about reloading?
Yeah. I mean, just to touch on that though, quick, I would agree everything you said. I think when I first started out, I left bow tuning to a shop for a little bit and I left cutting arrows to a shop and I started fletching my arrows.
Mm-hmm.
So that way I didn't handle anything else, but I started fletching and I like, oh, that got addicting. So the next purchase was an arrow saw. Next purchase after that was a bow press. Next purchase after that was, you know, a stand to mount everything on mm-hmm. and then a draw board. And then all of a sudden, you know, I'm doing everything. It's just like you start one little step and you're like, oh, I can tinker with it now. And then I can tinker with this and now I can repair things
mm-hmm.
when things break and work on it sooner. Don't have to drive like all the miles. Like I lived in Montana and at the time when I first started, I lived in Idaho. Bow shop was a long ways away. It was like 45 minutes one way.
Mm-hmm.
So like that adds up all that gas all the time in that time. So like I could just buy the stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Like the three trips I make down there in like a month to go to the bow shop on the weekends and pick things up. And then the time you wait, you could have all the equipment.
Yeah.
So it just like makes sense financially to eventually start doing it yourself.
Yeah. I mean, I will say
the
time
is the hard part though, but
yeah,
like and working on your stuff.
I'm like a huge, yeah. I think support your local shop. That's great. It's awesome. If they work for you and they're good, you know, good technicians and you know, you're getting good service and there's some absolutely awesome pro shops out there. Like utilize them if it's working for you. Do you know what I mean? Yeah, I'm not advocating that everybody should absolutely have their own press and their own saw and everything. It really just depends on you and what you want out of archery.
What you want out of it and what is your free time look like?
Yeah.
If you feel like you have some extra free time, this is going to be a great option. But if you don't have free time, you have kids, you have a family, you have multiple jobs, you work on the weekends.
I think
bow shop's a great thing.
It's like anything. It's like, what do you want to get out of it? Like, what are your goals and objectives? Yeah. Like, how much do you want to get out of it? And if you're like really into it and you want to make the most of it, you really enjoy it, I think you should do it. Just bite the bullet and go do it. Do all your own tuning and tinkering and just go all in, you know? But it really depends on kind of what you want to get out of archery, I would say. It's probably the same thing with reloading.
Yeah, and the reloading side, I mean, I think it's more important almost to find a mentor maybe first to learn. But with YouTube and with everything else nowadays, there's a lot of good informational sources to check out. But I think if you're just going to start out and you have a gun, you have your 6.8 Western that we just talked about.
I have my Great Elk gun.
Yeah, Great Elk gun. You want to start reloading for it, okay? What I would first start doing is I'd buy a bunch of brass, maybe factory loaded already. And that brass might not be the greatest quality, but it's going to get you by. Because again, we're starting out here. We're not trying to buy the premium best stuff ever right away. We're going to see if you enjoy this. So buy some factory rounds, maybe 40, maybe 60. Shoot all those. Save your brass. I will always say, anyone out there right now who's shooting factory rounds and they don't save their brass, like, please start saving your brass.
I'm that guy. I don't save it.
Yeah. You're probably throwing it in the trash can at the range.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Or throwing it in the bucket so they come pick it up. Like they're reselling that. You know, they're making money off you.
Yeah. I put it in the bucket.
Yeah. So like you can save your brass and you realize like, you know, some of the brass I buy is like $0.50, a buck per piece of brass. Can't remember. I haven't bought brass in a while.
Per round.
That's a lot.
Yeah, it's a lot.
And yeah, you know, so like start there, buy that, save your brass. Okay. There's so many different like reloading kits you could probably buy. And it's going to depend on what you want to spend now. Like the whole buy the best and cry just once, like always doesn't make sense in life, but like you can get by on some of those reloading kits because you need a reloading scale. You need a press. Like I started off on a single stage, Redding Big Boss 2 reloading press. It's great. I can only put one die in there at a time. It was really easy to use. And like, you don't have to be that expensive. You can buy a good scale because you have to be able to weigh all your powder out. And you just got to buy, you know, a bunch of other things, how to, you know, deprime and then some comparator gauges and different dies. You need a, you know, full length sizing die. You need a neck sizing die, depending on what you want to do with the bushing. But there's all sorts of different things you can do, but that's why, not to get in the weeds and explain everything, like there is reloading kits. Like you can get all this stuff bundled up.
What's in a reloading kit?
It's going to have like your press in there. It's going to have probably, you know, I can't remember, some of them do have scales in there, but it's going to give you a lot of the components you need because a lot of stuff you have to do to your brass, like
tumbler.
Yeah. Sometimes you can probably get a tumbler in some of those kits. Yeah. But I don't even tumble my brass anymore. Like I've washed that step out. Yeah. No, I washed it all the way out.
What do you mean you washed it out?
Just like I've tested it all and it doesn't add any like meaningful benefits. So like for a while I was washing my brass in stainless steel media. It's basically stainless steel little pins.
Yeah.
And you add some Dawn dish soap in there. It stirs around. The brass comes out looking brand new, like shiniest brass ever.
Okay.
But I'm actually taking off all that like carbon inside the necks every single time. So basically the brass is starting fresh.
So wait, you don't do that anymore?
Don't do that anymore. I've tried using like corn cob media or like walnut media in like a dry tumbler and dry tumbling it. Now I just use acetone.
So now you just take your brass.
Take my brass.
Put it.
After I shoot my rifle.
Pour out some acetone and just throw those in there.
Acetone on like a little container and dab it with a paper towel and just like clean off all the outside. Cause like you shoot your brass, you're going to get all sorts of different, you know, dust, lube from reloading.
What
all
about the oils inside?
No.
Nothing.
So
you just reload the powder.
I will do at the end of everything, I'll drop basically the same size caliber. So I shoot a 300. So it's a 308 caliber brush. One swipe with the brush down the neck and that's it.
Never get deeper than the neck.
Well, I mean, it goes down, but all it does is touch the neck. It doesn't touch any inside of the case or anything.
Yeah, right. You don't swab that. You're not cleaning the inside of it at all. Okay.
So I just clean off on the So I've learned over time, like, that's why a kit can be great to start. And you know, you're not going to get the most highest quality, but you'll be able to make, you'll still be able to make quality ammo.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm now chasing extreme accuracy. Like, you don't need to have, you know, I have a Area 419 zero press. It's a freaking, I think it's a $1,200 press now. I think it was $1,000 when I got it. That's a lot of money just for a.
It's not crazy though.
No. What do you think like of everything else in archery?
If you're into it, I mean, $1,200 isn't nuts.
Yeah. So it has a turret system on top so I can have all my dies set there. So I have, you know, a expander mandrel die. I have a body die. I have a neck die. I have all this stuff on there that I can work with my brass.
Mm-hmm.
And then I bought, you know, a lab grade quality scale to dispense my powder, and I have a custom thing that goes on top of that just because I'm geeking out on it. So that was another $1,200, so I'm starting to add up a little bit. And then I have all these other random components to you know, work different parts of my brass. But like,
but you can buy a kit.
You can buy a kit. It's going to help you a lot along mm-hmm. the ways. But like, so I started with something small. I didn't buy a kit. I piecemealed things that I kind of thought I needed, and you can get a lot of the stuff used. I'm telling you, like, there's a lot of good used stuff out there. Like, mm-hmm. there's so many different forms you can jump on. There's all sorts of different places you can get used reloading gear.
What about a workbench?
Workbench is key. I built my own workbench.
Yeah. So, I mean, the thing that made me think about that is I've had people ask me, they obviously ask a lot about your bow press, which is in Lorenzo's office. Yeah. It's a, you know, big stand that you,
it's basically a table saw.
It's a table saw stand that you built in. You've got your press attached to it. We've had people DM and ask questions on YouTube, things like that about your press stand. Mine's literally two C clamps on a regular desk in my basement.
Yeah, you can get by with anything.
And my arrow saw sits loose. Like I haven't bolted it down. I could, mm-hmm. I haven't, but it's, I mean, my workroom in my basement was not originally intended to be Trail's bow shop, which is what it is now.
Yeah.
It's essentially a laundry room, right? For my basement, but like, it's nothing crazy. I mean, it's just a basic shelf bench.
Yep. And you can do the same thing with reloading.
Yeah.
You can go bare basics, have an old kitchen table, like you can mm-hmm. use up in some little room or in your garage
or whatever. Pick one up off of Facebook Marketplace.
Pick it up on Facebook Marketplace. Mount some stuff to it. Drill some holes in it, like that you don't care about. You can mount everything to a small bench. Like you can even reload in the tiny room somewhere. If you're splitting a house with someone, you can load in your same bedroom.
Mm-hmm.
Like you don't need to have a lot of the geeky stuff. You can buy those stuff, slowly work your way up to it. Figure out if you love this thing, but definitely like consume all the content you can. Keep notes of everything. Document it all. Make sure everything's safe. Read through all that safety stuff. I think safety is obviously very important with the bow, but mm-hmm. it's even more important when you're dealing with gun, you're dealing with pressure, you're dealing with basically a mini bomb
mm-hmm.
going off.
Sure.
So like learn all you can about it, but you can, I don't know what you can start with for pretty cheap, probably around $500 or $600. Maybe you could probably start reloading
mm-hmm.
And then just have fun and test everything and document it all. But yeah. I mean, once you get in the weeds, like I am, like, at some point you realize you have to stop because like, okay, you're dealing with stuff that's like so small when I probably should just not spend all my time reloading and spend more time shooting and practicing. Mm-hmm. Same thing probably in archery. Like you could weigh every single arrow, yeah. you could spin it all and everything, but like really, can you shoot that great? Or should my time be better shooting and judging yardage and yeah. judging the wind and doing all that? So it's like,
yeah, I don't worry too much between like two or three grains between, you know, five or six arrows that I go hunting with, you know, yeah. I think the thing with archery equipment and doing your own work at home, I think everybody is a little bit intimidated. They're like, "Oh, I'm gonna screw this thing up." And you can screw a bow up. Like I've done it. Like I, you know, my brother had a Bowtech that I didn't put the draw stops back in, yeah. and just was out to lunch that day. Wasn't thinking. Went to pull the bow back, and you know, cam wrapped around, and I ended up having to pay for his new bow, which you know, torched a limb, bent the axle, the whole thing was a shit deal. So you can screw your bow up, but I think as long as you go slow and you pay attention, you've got some like attention to detail. And then I always tell people like, take notes as you go, start super slow and try things. And if you screw it up and it's not working out, you can always get it back to default where you started. Right. As long as you take notes and you learn as you go. And as you get better, the more confident that you get in it. And you are like, you start to understand like the impacts of like, okay, there's multiple ways I can fix this high left paper tear. Right. And they automatically come to you because you've been doing it for long enough, but you're never going to get there if you don't start.
Yep. And like the beauty nowadays is like, sure, I have notebooks for every single rifle I have, mm-hmm. like literally paper notebook. And I write down everything I do all the time. But I also have things on, you know, like a Google Drive. Like Google Docs are amazing. I can pull it up on my phone. I can pull it up on my computer. I literally write down step by step. Mm-hmm. Here's what I do on, you know, virgin brass. So brass that has never been shot before. Here's the exact steps I go through on virgin brass to shoot it for the first time. So say I'm getting a brand new gun, never shot that brass. These are steps I go to. Then I have another section that's like, okay, these are fire brass steps, because the fire brass steps compared to the virgin brass steps are slightly different. But it's like, so I write down an exact step, like no joke. Step one, you know, remove a primer. That seems silly, but it's like, okay, you want to remove your spent primer before you start doing everything else. Right. Because you're like writing it down to help you. It might seem basic, but it's like later on when I go through it, I'm like, oh yeah, what's my 300 rum use for a comparator gauge? What is my 300 Win Mag use for a comparator gauge? Like I have all that stuff written down on there. What's the anneal code on my amp annealer? And I'm annealing my brass, heating up the end of it, like for the rum compared to something else. Writing all that down. That way when I literally have it on a piece of paper, all the steps I do to make a perfect piece of brass for me. Yes, it can be different. Like you could tune your bow different than I can tune my bow. Mm-hmm. We could kind of end up in the same results.
Yep.
So this is what works for me, but I have it written down.
Yeah.
Everything.
And you can probably find online steps.
Steps,
and
yeah. Not,
and you then, can look and for then it. As you work through it, you find things that work better for you.
Yeah, and always read things with a grain of salt, yeah. Because like there's a lot of good information out there, and I probably gave bad information before, but it's sure. Like, maybe that's all I knew at the time, like, yeah. Or I messed yeah. up saying something on a podcast. Yeah. Like, who knows? Like, just do your research though and vet it from a lot of different sources till you know what actually works, and then test it with yourself. And eventually, you have a great shooting bow. You can have a great shooting rifle.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's nothing better than reloading your own ammo. I think it's so fun, but you gotta have time for it too.
Yeah, not for everybody.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's the thing. All things aren't for everybody, which is fine. So pick and choose.
Mm-hmm.
What do you got? You got another one?
Yeah, the last one I got is from Henry. Say, hey, Brady, just listened to the recent podcast on y'all's sleep system. Some great insights on when and why you choose certain things over others. I've been looking into getting a new shelter. You mentioned a couple Hilleberg tents. I looked at those, but were wondering if you guys had any insights on third versus fourth season tents. Most of my hunts have been mid-season in the Dakotas, but I have a hunt in Montana this November. In your experience, will a three-season tent suffice for most hunts?
Yes.
Exactly what I put. 100% yes.
Yeah, it will. I would say it's a pretty rare case when you actually would be find yourself in an environment where you need a true like four season tent.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we talked about it on that podcast. Like four season doesn't mean that it's like necessarily any warmer or anything like that. It's just beefed up materials. So
durable. The poles might be more burly. The placement of everything is going to be maybe more low profile to handle some winds, maybe some less ventilation.
Yeah.
To maybe try to hold some of that heat in there, but not always.
Yeah, so beefier fly, beefier materials, beefier stakes, poles. Mm-hmm. It's just beefed up for harsher weather conditions.
Yeah.
But I think most people would totally be fine with a shoulder season tent, so a three season tent.
Yep. So those would be great. And then it's obviously utilizing all your guidelines, always being smart with that, mm-hmm. smart with your tent placement, and then obviously having everything else compound inside there. Like if you have a three-season tent, and then you have a quality sleeping pad, you have a quality sleeping bag, you can get through a lot of conditions out there.
Mm-hmm.
Like you'll survive and you'll thrive, actually.
For sure.
You have a really good time out there. And then you're saving weight, too. Usually a fourth-season mm-hmm. tent is going to have a weight penalty.
Yeah.
Not all the time, but a lot of times it's going to be, like I said, heavier, beefier, bulkier.
Mm-hmm.
Like, but you don't need that on most hunts.
Yeah, I would say most people don't need it.
Yeah.
I can't think of a hunt that I've been on where I was like, man, I really wished I had or needed a true four season tent. Like
mm-hmm.
most of the stuff is completely mellow for three season tent, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. I've had some bad winds and some bad storms, some snow, but I can't think of anything that a three season tent wouldn't handle.
Mm-hmm.
Good one. Okay. I got one more, a couple more actually. We'll blow through them pretty quick. We're an hour and 28 minutes. Has it felt like that?
No.
It's gone pretty quick. Okay. This is an archery-related question. And I actually replied to this guy, but I think it's good intel to put out to the masses. I saw Tim Gillingham just did a post about it today, which also made me think, maybe we should cover it. But basically it said, I see more people talking about sighting in their bow for the elevation that they will be hunting, but what are the possible impacts and then what do I do to fix it? So I talked about it on my podcast, but essentially... if you go up, so you sight your bow in, right? And let's say you live, I live in Cedar, 5,700 feet. What's the, do you know the elevation here in Vegas?
Like two
something. So the air is dense. It's thicker, right? So then when you move up, maybe you're hunting alpine mule deer or you're hunting elk at Timberline and you're at 10,500 or 11,000 foot. Essentially the air center. So you have less drag, less resistance, mm-hmm. and your point of impact is going to be higher because there's less drag mm-hmm. on your veins, all the component, even your arrow itself. So, that's what the problem would be essentially. And it's probably not that big of a deal when you look at sight tapes from maybe 20 to 50, 60 yards, maybe. Like if I live in Cedar and I sight my bow in at 5,700 foot, if I go up to 11, you know, 20 to 60, it's not going to be crazy difference. Mm-hmm. Where I think you really start to notice it, and Tim was talking about it today, was when you get out past like 70, 80, 90, you're going to start to see differences in your point of impact. It's going to hit higher. Mm-hmm. And I think we talked about it, but every year I go to TAC and, you know, you run up there and your first shot is a bedded elk at 104 yards and pretty much everybody is like 3 to 4 inches high. Now, are you taking shots like that, 100 yards on an animal in the field when you're hunting? Probably not, but for a follow-up area, it'd be nice to know, right? Mm-hmm. Or if you're using a single pin slider, you know, maybe 20 to 60, you might have a slightly higher impact point at elevation. So that's the issue. How do you fix it? I think Precision Cut Archery's got a great little program where you can input your altitude, air density, don't quote me if I got that exactly right, but basically your altitude. And you can actually play with it and you can input different altitudes and you can see what the two different sight tapes look like in comparison one to the other. Mm-hmm. I think ideally, you know, build a sight tape for the altitude that you're likely to be hunting at and then verify it if you can when you get there. If not, and what I told this person is at a minimum, when you get there, shoot your bow as close as you possibly can to the elevation that you're going to be hunting at just to verify your pins. So I would say shoot your 20 through your 60, you know, take a shot at 80 and 100 and verify your tape and check to see where it's at. If it's not hitting where you want it to, if it's hitting high, take a marker and make note of it, or at a minimum, make a middle note of it. Like, hey, at camp before I left, I shot and it took a 80 yard poke and I hit 4 inches high. I know that, if I have a follow-up shot at 80 yards, I need to set that sight at like 78 or 79 yards.
Okay.
Just make a note of it. That's like bare minimum. Ideally, I would say build a sight tape for the altitude you're hunting at and then try to verify it.
So is this whole bit of information relatively new?
Pretty new. Because I would say I've only ever really heard it talked about like within the last year, maybe.
Yeah, because I've mm-hmm. bow hunted a long, sure. long time. Never really heard of that. But you hear about this all the time, rifle hunting. Mm-hmm. Like, hey, I live at sea level.
Oh, yeah.
I'm going to go hunting to Colorado. I'm going to be hunting at 9,000 feet. The difference is, some people are like, when do you need a Kestrel? When do you need a ballistic range finding thing? Like, it's kind of the same thing, like 0 to 400 yards. You might not really notice anything, but you get out further, mm-hmm. and then you start to notice things a little bit. It's like the rifle stuff still seems like it's been that way for a long time, but it's, I don't know, 10 years or so, it's like really picked up and gained the mm-hmm. momentum. People are probably shooting further and further all the time. So
yeah, people are building custom turrets for the elevation that they plan to hunt at.
Yeah. And so, like, I haven't really heard an archery.
Yeah, I would say it's pretty new, like recent development, and it probably has a lot to do with Precision Cut. Tristan over there, kind of his model and the program that he's built, that people are starting to be able to see the difference in their sight tapes from where they sight in to where, you know, they're mm-hmm. hunting. And, you know, maybe it's less of a conversation because, like I said, the difference between like 20 to 60 is pretty minimal. You get out extended distance, and maybe it has to do with more people now practicing a lot more.
Shooting TAC events and noticing this. And
yeah,
so they found a solution for a problem they're dealing mm-hmm. with in a certain shooting situation that was exposed at shooting yeah. high elevations all the time where they come from a different elevation. So
yeah, and I would say it's generally a good thing. I think people are better shots that collectively mm-hmm. there are more people now. I mean, a lot of people are shooting hinges and thumb button releases, and a lot of people are shooting back bars and
yep.
you know, better balanced bows and tuning. We talked about that, like probably bows that are a lot more tuned and Intune than they ever were 20 years ago, right? Yeah. Like, you know, the old Q2, who knew what it did through paper when I shot it in 2002, right?
Yeah.
I have no idea. Yeah, I actually don't, but but yeah, spine. People know way more about spine of arrows and stiffness and veins and drag. Yeah. Like, there's so much more information. I would say generally people are much, much better shots and better into it than they used to be. So maybe there are people that are much more interested in what their pen is doing at 70, 80, 90, 100 yards than they used to be.
When I was in high school, this was never a thought process.
No, never.
When I was in college, when mm-hmm. I lived out west, never was like, oh yeah, I need to have different, wonder what it does at elevation compared to where I'm living right now by the river. Like, you just shot what it was and
you sighted your pens and went hunting, right?
Yeah.
And likely like, it probably didn't matter much because most of your shots were going to be within 45, 50 yards anyway.
But it's mm-hmm. cool though, having that ability now to do that and be like, okay, it wasn't me that day. Because mm-hmm. that could add a mental frustration. Like, why am I hitting high?
Sure.
Like, I need to adjust everything. But now mm-hmm. knowing you have a fix for that or the reason behind it, you can be like, oh, I'm shooting high because of the elevation, because of this. Like, it's not me. My bow's still in tune, but I actually need a different tape when I'm going to shoot some of these events. So like, mm-hmm. eventually this is going to make everyone a better archer because you have more information presented to you. You have means to look at stuff. And I think that's mm-hmm. badass that archery is getting into that yeah. side of me. It's been there when the sight tape thing came about, but like, yeah. Precision cut archery.
Yeah, pretty cool.
Pretty cool.
Yeah, absolutely. I have shown up to a hunt. I went on an elk hunt not that many years ago and shot up to 11,000 foot, getting ready to take the pack and get it ready to go. Thought, you know what, let's shoot 20 and 60 just to verify. And I was hot on both of them. I ended up telling Neville and his brother, go ahead, leave without me. I'm going to spend the next hour and a half, 2 hours reciting every single pin and checking my tape, which I did. And then caught up with them, you know, later that night, hiked it in the dark. So yeah, I wouldn't say just because you sighted your bow in, you know, on the coast, you live in California or Florida or Iowa or wherever it might be, to just show up and assume that you're hitting behind the pin at, you know, 10,500 foot or whatever.
That's a big deal.
Yeah, it is a big deal. And then, I mean, man, there's nothing worse than like hitting an animal and wounding it, not finding it, or missing an animal completely, and then like not knowing exactly why.
Not knowing exactly
like,
why.
Like, man, I didn't actually verify my pins. I don't know where it was hitting. It really sucks. Not a good feeling.
Yeah.
Last question. This guy said, bivy elk hunting tactics, specifically hunting them at dark, which I don't know exactly what that means. I would assume maybe in the evenings, or like, what do you do? Where do you go at night? How do you do it? Anything you got would be appreciated. Bivy elk hunting tag. So I think he's probably primarily talking archery elk hunting. So I thought my system, I'll just run through it real quick. Rab Alpine Bivy, which is essentially Event waterproof sack. I put my sleeping pad in it. I put my bag in it. I often pack a Tyvek, the Go Hunt Tyvek sheet. I'll put that underneath it just for added protection for my sleeping pad. And like I said, that serves as a second use for me, is like, keeping my meat clean when I bone an animal out on it. Right. Tarp, I'll pack a tarp. So the Go Hunt Dyneema tarp, I only pitch that if it looks like it's going to rain. Sleeping bag is usually, you know, an Argali 20 degree Alpine, or like the Hilleberg, or not the Hilleberg, the Western Mountaineering, Versalite. I get asked a lot, like, where do you camp?
That's what I think the question was more leaning to me. In the evening? So you're getting on a bull,
mm-hmm.
you're hunting him, it gets dark, he's there still, but maybe you backed off a little bit. Where are you camping from that bull?
Yes. Oh, I like to put like a ridge line between me and them. So if they've gone up and over a ridge line, or they're in a canyon, and I kind of followed them till dark, or they're bugling in a canyon bottom, or kind of up in the top end of the drainage. Or maybe they've moved down like into a feeding, like into a meadow in a flat, right? I like to put a ridge line between me and them if I can, camp in it, like in the bottom. Elk behavior, right? So elk will feed downhill typically in the evening. They'll come downhill, they'll find a meadow, they'll turn around, and then early morning they'll feed uphill when the thermals are coming downhill, right? So you just want to be aware of thermals. So at night, like, I don't want to camp above them if they're below me, because my thermals are going to blow downhill to them, right? So mm-hmm. I try to just play the thermals and play the prevailing wind. I like to put a ridge between me and them if I can. And what I'm doing is I'm being mindful of the thermals. I'm being mindful of the wind. And then in the morning, I'm like everything in my backpack, and I'm moving in the general direction that I last heard them the night before, or hopefully in the middle of the night.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's one of my favorite, is like, I rarely sleep like an entire night when I'm bivvied out, right? Like I'll wake up, I'll have to pee.
Yeah.
When I get up to pee in the middle of the night, I'm going to stand there for 10 or 15, 20 minutes. And I'm going to listen. Like what elk are, what are they doing? You know, mm-hmm. if they're below me, you know, over the canyon or wherever it might be, like I'm taking note of where those elk are. So, and then trying to predict, I do a lot of predicting. I've actually thought a lot of lately, like what makes like a good, successful elk hunter. You know, I listened to a lot of the podcasts that Peen Wild did. He did a whole series. I think he's 8 episodes in right now with different guys that hunt elk and love bow hunting elk. I think collectively, like people that are really consistently killing elk, I think they're really good at predicting what elk are going to do and why. Like, why are they going there?
Mm-hmm.
How can I cut the distance to them? Can I get up there and be in front of them? Can I come in from the side? Whatever it might be, like they're really good at predicting where elk are going and why. And so I'm always trying to think like, and people get pinned down all the time. They're like, well, they're the elk, but they're thinking just where they're at, not where they're going.
Yeah.
Cause elk are big and they move a lot.
Mm-hmm. I like that.
In the morning they're feeding and they're going to a bedding area. In the evening, they're getting up from their bed, they're feeding, they're moving back towards feed, or they're moving to water. Yeah, I'm always trying to predict where I should go and why I should go there based on why I think elk do what they do. So I think like understanding elk and killing elk, I think you have to like think like an elk mm-hmm. a little bit.
But so you're trying to tap into your Neuralink system that you also have an elk tapped in over there. So you were trying to read minds.
Wouldn't that be fun?
Wonder what that would be
if
like.
If you could Neuralink an elk and understand
what it is for one day.
What it is they're actually thinking about and how they're processing.
Come on, Elon. Let's work on that.
Come on, Elon. And then I could just wire that in and I could think like an elk, like really like an elk. That would be fascinating.
They'd be thinking, oh, shoot, we heard trails here. We're in trouble this week. That's what they'd be thinking.
Dude, I just think they're thinking food, water, love. That's what they're thinking about in the rut. And maybe love, water, food in that order when the rut's really rolling. But
so human.
That's it. Yeah, they're not all that different.
Yeah. Except they're way cooler than humans, huh?
Yeah, I think so. With that, yeah. Do you have any others? Are you good?
Nope, that was it. Just a quick scroll through the DMs. As always, I feel bad because I know there's probably a lot more. This time of year, it's hard to get back to people, and I do apologize. I love DMs, but mm-hmm. I apologize. When I see them, it's usually a bad time. If you catch me in a good time, I definitely shoot you back a message right away, but...
That's me, man. I answer, I would say, I want to say like 80% of them, but every once in a while I'll get one when I'm driving or like I'm working and I'm like trying to do something and I think, oh shit, I didn't get back to that person. So anyway, with that, that's the week and we'll be back next week.
Thanks,
Rick.